This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of August 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Governor Abbott proposes freezing property tax revenue in cities that cut police funding.
They will never be able to increase property tax revenue again.
Public health officials worried about school reopenings.
I think there's no doubt that we're going to see cases.
And the COVID risks of marching band.
They're just ready to be back and be with their friends and get back into their routines and feel normal again.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. Some of the most powerful statewide politicians in Texas sat side by side this week in Fort Worth and announced a policy proposal aimed directly at Austin.
When crime is on the rise, the last thing that we should do is to defund law enforcement. And yet that is exactly what the city of Austin did.
This is Governor Greg Abbott.
Well, to maintain the safety that our communities deserve, today we are announcing a legislative proposal that will discourage defunding law enforcement agencies in Texas. The way this proposal works is this. Any city that defunds police departments will have its property tax revenue frozen at the current level. They will never be able to increase property tax revenue again if they defund police.
Of course, this is not even a bill yet and would have to be passed by the state legislature to become law, and the legislature does not meet again until next year. But the head of the Texas Senate, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, will be there next year.
We will be ready in the Senate to work on this legislation and make it a priority. When I think about what Austin has done, had any other mayor of any other city in Texas been as irresponsible as they have been, they would have chaos and their citizens would be in danger. It is only because of our DPS force of state troopers, hundreds that came to the aid and rescue of the brave officers at APD, that Austin didn't turn into a potential Seattle or Portland.
Okay, so we're going to get to what Austin actually did and did not do in a moment. First, let's hear how Austin Mayor Steve Adler responded to this. He says he got no advance notice of the press conference or the announcement. So here's how he started his news conference.
Today, we mourn the deaths of more than 10,000 Texans that have died from COVID-19. I think it's only right and appropriate that we take a moment of silence for so many that have died.
This moment of silence lasted about 10 seconds, and then Adler came back with this.
Why wasn't the press conference this afternoon about the single biggest public safety crisis in Texas? As a mayor of a Texas city, I'm proud that cities stepped forward when the state would not, effectively to stop the virus back in March. I don't know where the state was. Cities led and helped save thousands of lives.
And he spoke about COVID-19 for a while and then got to the actual proposal from state leaders.
The press conference today was not about facts. It presented no plans. It presented no data. It was about trying to make us scared, of frightening us, and of furthering lies. It's really a shame that some feel the best way to reach people is to peddle fear, trading in fear. To avoid having to actually engage in real policy conversations is a sickness that I hope we turn away from in November.
So basically what Adler is saying is that Austin did not cut $150 million from the police department budget, but he likes to say Austin did something transformative. That's the word he likes to use. And we covered this last week. But basically, here's what the city council did. Austin City Council cut $20 million from the police budget effective immediately. That's about 5% of the police budget. That includes canceling a cadet class and eliminating 150 vacant officer positions. Another $80 million is being removed from APD's budget and put into other departments. Divisions are being moved out from under APD. So, for example, the city council taking the 911 call center out from under APD, and internal affairs will still exist, will still cost the city money, but it won't be under APD. That's the $80 million. And then $50 million of APD's budget is being put into a holdover fund that could be cut or could go back into the police budget. That's to be determined. So that's how they get to the $150 million. Healthcare programs in Texas are facing cuts in the current state budget that runs through next year. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the cuts are in response to the state's financial problems during the pandemic.
Some of the proposals include cuts to women's health, early childhood intervention for babies and toddlers with disabilities, and staff that help families sign up for services like Medicaid. Peter Clark with the nonprofit Texans Care for Children says state lawmakers could be dipping into the rainy day fund or seeking more federal assistance instead of cutting badly needed programs. Clark also says Texas families should have input and this process should be more transparent.
We are about to hit the end of the fiscal year, and if the cuts are just going to be implemented without any formal decision or public announcement or public discussion, then that is really concerning.
Clark says this process is making it hard to anticipate what's going to happen with the next budget, which lawmakers will begin hammering out early next year. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The city of Kyle decided this week to change the name of Rebel Drive to Fajita Drive, in part to follow suit with Hayes High School, which recently agreed to retire the Rebel mascot. City council members also wanted to honor Sonny Falcone, who was a Kyle native and known to many as the creator of the fajita. But some residents are saying the city of Kyle missed the mark. So KUT's Rianne Roldan has that.
Residents were quick to take to social media to voice their dislike for the road that stretches for about 2 miles. A lot of people thought it was a joke, but when they realized it wasn't, many were frustrated there wasn't more community outreach. Lifelong Kyle resident Abigail Silva started a petition that already has almost 600 signatures. She appreciated that the city was trying to honor the Hispanic community in Kyle, but said it just doesn't translate.
It's laughable, and I don't think that our culture is laughable. I don't think any culture is laughable, but naming it after something that I think could be seen as something that's funny, I don't think that it does justice to our community or to our culture and any kind of diversity.
In a statement, Mayor Travis Mitchell said the council's intentions were good, but that given community discomfort, he'll hold a public hearing on the item at the next council meeting on September 1st. Rianne Roldan, KUT News.
And now the latest on COVID-19 in Austin. This week, the cumulative number of cases since the beginning of the pandemic surpassed the 25,000 mark in Travis County. Vast majority of those people have recovered, 23,700. 346 people have died from COVID-19 in Travis County, and about 1,000 people remain active cases. Now, the two go-to officials on this are the director of Austin Public Health, Stephanie Hayden, and the interim health authority, Dr. Mark Escott. Each week, they hold a media briefing and answer questions, usually lasts an hour or so. And by the way, you can go to the City of Austin TV website and watch the whole thing if you want. It gets archived. But I just wanted to bring a few standout moments. Hayden talked about the current clusters of cases. There are some in nursing homes, some in apartment buildings. They keep a watch list whenever there are more than three cases in a specific business, for example, and they'll try and intervene with that business. But Hayden said one of the biggest challenges right now are small gatherings of families and friends.
Whether it is birthday parties or any type of celebrations, we know that those are continuing to happen. And so it's going to be important, as we stated earlier, that we cannot have those types of celebrations. It's important for us to make new traditions and find other ways to socially distance and ensure that even with our family or other people that we may hang around, our friends, that we may tend to go out to eat and hang out with. And so it's when we take our guard down and say, oh, this is my best friend. I've known her for all of my life. You know, I don't think I can get COVID from her. Well, the answer to that is yes, you can. And as soon as you say that, you can just tell by looking at a person if they have COVID-19, you cannot tell. You cannot make that decision by looking at that person. So do what you can to maintain your relationships, but we really prefer that you not have those celebrations.
And Dr. Escott's big thing was back to school. A bunch of school districts in Central Texas resumed class this week, including the Bastrop, Del Valle, Dripping Springs, Georgetown, Lake Travis, Manor, Round Rock, and Wimberley Independent School Districts, also Harmony Charter Schools. Every district has a different plan for when they'll go back to in-person learning, but the state has told districts they can do online learning for 4 weeks and apply for longer. Students at the University of Texas at Austin began moving in this week for the fall semester. In that regard, university-owned residence halls will be operating with social distancing measures in place. Cloth mask requirements will be in place. Most residence hall rooms will be double occupancy. And in-person instruction at UT starts August 26th and ends the day before Thanksgiving. But the university says almost half of students will be learning online only, and those who do take part in-person instruction will be in classrooms with a maximum capacity of 40%. The classrooms will be at 40% capacity max. So in that context, Dr. Escott was asked, are you concerned?
I think there's no doubt that we're going to see cases associated with schools and universities. I don't think the expectation is that we're going to shut down every school or recommend the shutdown of colleges or universities that have a single case or small cluster. If that's the expectation, my advice would be that we not go back to school in person. That's not going to be sustainable. What we are doing is we're focusing on introducing a small number of students. Our recommendation is that public schools and private alike start with no more than 25% of the occupancy of the school there in person. I think if we work slowly, if we progress as we achieve success, then we are more likely to have continuity of education. I think that advice is true for colleges and universities as well. You know, one thing that's challenging at colleges and universities is that it's not just about the classroom space. The students are together in dorms and fraternity and sorority houses or in apartment complexes. They're gathering in social gatherings as well, which makes it a much more complicated situation.
He says the scientific data shows school-age children and college-age students are much less likely to have a severe outcome if they're infected with the coronavirus, but people in both age groups have died. The real, more substantial risk, Escott said, is to faculty and staff, or students bringing the virus home and infecting their parents or their grandparents. By the way, Texas this week, as you heard Mayor Adler say earlier, surpassed 10,000 COVID deaths, although some observers believe that number is an underestimate. The pandemic has hit the hospitality industry harder than any other sector of the economy. Hotel occupancy in Austin has plunged to less than half of what it was at this time last summer. The city of Austin is expecting to lose more than $30 million in the taxes that get charged on hotel stays, and that's going to have implications for the Austin Convention Center. That's going to have an effect on cultural arts funds and music funds that the city maintains with that hotel tax revenue. The Convention Center alone has already lost more than $16 million just from canceled conventions. So I spoke with Steve Genovese. He's with the local tourism bureau, Visit Austin.
It's been devastating to our industry. I think people have said it's our Great Depression for the hospitality industry. We've never seen anything like it. Many layoffs, furloughs, and it's not just the hotels that's been impacted, but when you don't have visitors staying in the hotels, then it impacts all the small businesses that people go out and enjoy as well when they're staying in a hotel.
What's the latest data that you have in terms of measuring the exact impact of the pandemic on the local hotel industry?
Really, the main measurement that we're looking at right now is the occupancy for the hotels, because the faster we can get this occupancy to increase, the more jobs, hopefully, that can come back and be employed in what is the third largest industry for jobs in Austin. So right now, when you look at the running 28 days as of August 5th, we're running about 35.7% occupancy in the entire market. That would be downtown and the entire Austin market area. To give you some perspective, same time last year for those running 28 days, we were running 75.1% hotel occupancy. And again, that's how hotels staff their employees and how business flows is heads in beds. So it's pretty significant.
So less than half the occupancy compared to the same time last year. What does the recovery look like? Will the local hotel industry ever be able to bounce back to where it was before?
It's going to be a long process, and it's going to take everyone's help, all avenues to come together and come up with, you know, moving the industry forward. And the first part that predicted to come back, and of course, it all gets back to people feeling safe to stay in a hotel. And a lot of the hotels are doing incredible things to make their customers feel safe, is the leisure vacationers, the people, you know, coming from within the state, maybe the region, getting in the car and driving to Austin and having a great, you know, vacation stay. So that will be the first to come back. Second will be business travel, where companies lift their travel bans, and then there's business travel, and then conferences and meetings and sporting events, a huge part of the economy for Austin right now, will take some time, and it'll probably be with smaller meetings and events first, growing to larger meetings and events from there. So it will be a step-by-step process, but we'd love to just start seeing, and we started seeing some of those leisure vacationers come to Austin until we had the spike. Now, with the decline, we're starting to see a little bit of occupancy on the weekends. I also heard there were some weddings, you know, taking place, things of that nature, on a very limited basis. So it's going to be a long process, and sometimes the industry is saying that it could take, you know, 3 to 4 years to really get back to the levels that we were enjoying in 2019. And Austin clearly ran the highest hotel occupancy in the entire state. So we have a long way to go to get back to where we were.
All right. Thanks so much for your time today, Steve. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chocolate is a wonderful thing. It can bring people together. As Ina Ganguly found out when she stopped at the store in her hometown earlier this year, we put out a call for your stories about overcoming differences for our Common Ground project. Ina tells us about her encounter with a stranger at the store.
There it was, the grocery store of my adolescence, where my mother dragged me to once a week only to dictate all that got put into the shopping cart. She ruled over what I ate, creating in me this dream to live indulgently. This desire dug deep into me through the years, until I had my own shopping cart. The ability to make my own decisions about what I cooked made me feel powerful, creative. Though I moved away, I never stopped visiting my mother in the suburb I grew up in. On one such visit, I brought the love of my life, Liza, home with me. On our way to my mother's house, we had to stop by that grocery store to get one of the absolute essentials for human survival, chocolate. We stepped into the store and made our way through the familiar floor plan till we reached our destination, the Isle of Sweets. I eyed the different brands, noticing some familiar ones. Cadbury, the first chocolate I ever tasted as a baby in India. Hershey's, my first chocolate when I arrived to the States. I thumbed through the various thoughtfully crafted chocolate wrappers to see their different cacao content, some as high as 90%. So strong, I could almost taste its bitterness. There was no one else on our aisle. It was just me, my girlfriend Liza, and endless possibilities of candy to choose from. Or so I thought. A young man about my age, dressed in a pizza delivery uniform, interrupted my thoughts to ask, "What kind of chocolate do you like?" Instinctively, my body inched closer to Liza, the taste of fear suddenly, surprisingly, seeping into my mouth. Reason told me this was a friendly question. Intuition told me to be careful. I looked at the girl with him, thinking he might be talking to her. She gave me a half tight-lipped smile back. My body, still tense, inched back to where I stood. I tried to keep calm without letting my guard down. "I'm serious. What kind of chocolate do you like?" he asked again. "It's okay. You're okay," my spirit whispered, as my mouth now began to taste contemplation. "What kind of chocolate do I like?" With my partner beside me as witness, I said, "Anything with wafers in it. I am a sucker for crispy things in chocolate." My eyes turned to him, slightly embarrassed about my initial reaction. "What about you?" I don't remember what he said. Maybe he said he liked caramel. I was still nervous. Protective, cautious, ready to fight. That's how he had caught me feeling. Until he handed me a few dollar bills and said, "The chocolates are on me." Immediately, my wariness melted, not unlike how chocolate melts when met with a warm and waiting mouth. "That's so sweet. Are you sure?" I glanced back at his friend again. This time, she gave me a full-on grin. "Yeah, of course. Enjoy it." And I wondered if this was his tip money for the day. Without further explanation, they waved goodbye. On my way to pay for my chosen sweets, I swear I caught a reflection of younger me, grinning from ear to ear. Getting chocolate from a kind stranger in the same grocery store where, all those years ago, I felt nothing but yearning. Wanting my decisions about food to be heard. Wanting nothing more but the freedom to choose.
That was Ina Ganguly. Her story was produced as part of our Common Ground project in partnership with the Austin Public Library and the Library Foundation. You can hear more of these at KUT.org. Marching band is a huge part of the high school experience for a lot of kids in Austin and across Texas, but it is an activity that involves a lot of breathing and saliva, and those are transmitters of the coronavirus. But still, the show goes on at a lot of schools all over the country. So let's go to West Texas. Sarah Self-Walbrick reports on band camp at Lubbock High School.
5, 6...
It's day 4 of summer marching band practice at Lubbock High School. Students in shorts and t-shirts take measured steps in a parking lot next to the school under an unforgiving noontime sun. 16-year-old saxophone player Tristan Wright isn't rehearsing today.
I just want to help be able to give people that one constant, you know, that one constant being band and having this community of people.
After 6 years of playing, Wright is a band leader and now mentors the younger members. 130 students are at band camp this year, a lot of them incoming freshmen.
Between the online and in-person, it's going to look a bit different than, you know, everybody's in the band hall playing their instruments.
Wright says he'll take academic classes online in the fall, but will attend marching band in person. The school district is the only public one in the city, allowing students to do virtual classes, but participate in certain face-to-face activities.
I want instant sound on the downbeat. You do not have to hesitate. You know what the exercise is.
Block the band director, Melanie Settle, walks the through the rows of students, spaced 6 feet apart, and gives directions through a headset microphone and a face mask.
Quality.
Everyone wears a mask. It's required by the Lubbock Independent School District. brass and woodwind musicians pull their masks below their chins when it's time to play. After a surge of COVID cases in June, Lubbock has averaged a steady 90 new cases a day since July 1st. State guidelines allowed for summer marching band practices to start in August. Not every Texas district returned, but Lubbock ISD chose to. The district's fine arts director, Andrew Babcock, says based on research he's seen, marching band isn't much riskier than sitting in a math class. But he is following state guidelines, and they've come up with their own precautions. Practice is mostly outside and in smaller than usual groups.
We are doing mandated temperature checks for every student as they get out of their vehicle. So before they can even get onto the practice lot, we're doing all of the pre-symptom checks on every student.
Thank you. This is a new exercise. I've never done it before. I understand the confusion. Here we go. Great rest.
Settle says when the state gave the green light for school districts to have summer band practice, her students were excited.
They're just ready to be back and be with their friends and get back into their routines and feel normal again.
She says the students are taking the safety measures seriously so they can continue with the season, which will include the usual halftime performances at football games and band competitions.
So to have everybody back in the same space and remember that we're all in the same, we're all on the same journey, we're all doing the same thing, man, that culture it's priceless in person.
Band leader Tristan Wright says band makes school worthwhile for him. After graduation, he says he may pursue music education.
I've always just had, a drive to be here for band. The core classes, I'll go to those, but it's really band that keeps me interested and invested in school. It's what gets me up, and that's something that's just stayed with me.
Wright isn't the only student who feels that way about his extracurricular passion. Babcock, the district's fine arts director, says the majority of Lubbock ISD kids participate in the arts, and the social and emotional effects of participating in person balance the risk of gathering together during the pandemic.
This little window into a piece of normal that's done differently but still somewhat normal is filling a void that is really hard to quantify.
Can you take the quality of that sound and put it on the move? 16 to 5. Point to where you will be in 16 steps.
About a week after band camp started, at the beginning of this month, the school district confirmed one person with the Lubbock High band tested positive for COVID-19. The district superintendent and the principal wrote a statement to parents saying the exposure was low risk. The message from school leaders states, practice continues. In Lubbock, I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick.
That's KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of August 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.